Okay, everybody, welcome to this talk. I'm going to spend a half hour trying to give people some insight into the engineering manual, a little bit of history on how it was developed. I think this is good for new engineers because many new engineers are not even aware of the fact they're supposed to be following the manual. And, I will try to give you a little insight into how the manual fits into everything else that works at the lab. So, share this. Okay, where did my arrows? Okay, am I on reduced view here? I probably am. There we go.
That looks better, Paul.
Okay, thank you. So I like to call this talk the Engineering Manual, Mysteries of Engineering Revealed, and a subtitle, Navigating the Engineering Manual. So the manual, so the question is, where did it come from? And back a long time ago, Fermilab was involved in building LHC quadrupoles for CERN. And one of our quadrupoles had a problem that damaged part of the CERN string. So that put a lot of egg on our faces. And I know our director was very, very upset at the time. So Pierre Adone asked that I would investigate and find out what happened. It's long been my policy to not suffer death by PowerPoint, so I held a working technical review instead. DOE insisted the lab bring in an outside company to do the same thing, to look into what happened. I will euphemistically refer to them as Beltway Bandits. They were a company that was located in the Beltway just outside of Washington. And so the history at the lab at the time that the prototype was done, or the magnet design was done, was heavily centered on prototyping as a key element. So it was not unusual for projects to be developed, to do a prototype, and then if there were problems, correct them. Unfortunately, we could not do it for this large, expensive quadrupole magnet. So they were forced to do straight design work and do it to spec as they had gotten from CERN. So what we found out was that the information from CERN was incorrect, and the actual vent back pressure was higher than stated.
Oh, just fighting. No,
just
wanted to have that
asparagus. Could you mute your audio, please?
It's good.
They're sweet. At least they don't matter. I mean, so far, they don't
matter. The back pressure was higher than stated, and so the design was off to a poor start. Also, after a design review that was done at Fermilab, verbal communications of an engineering change that was needed went from Fermi to our partner lab. The key there is it was a verbal communication. Hey, you guys need to do this. You need to beef up this one part of the design. The partner lab, since they were charged with the construction, actually gave a verbal change request to one of our vendors. And this resulted in a misunderstanding, and there was no follow-up. So here we had two things in a chain that set us up for a problem. The misunderstanding was one that was caused because the vendor always did a certain process. Partner lab said, hey, you have to do this, namely weld this part. they took it to mean, oh, you have to tack weld it, which is what they always did. So they tack welded it instead of a full weld. As a result, there was a failure. So the outside company, the Beltway Bandits, looked at the lab and they faulted us for not having an engineering manual. And DOE was also interested in having a manual at the time. So a team was put together by Pierre Adone, the director, to develop a manual. Originally, we were told that Lawrence Berkeley Lab had a black book for engineering. So when I contacted Berkeley and I asked my colleague there about the black book, his reply was pretty straightforward. What black book? So that left us in a vast desert where we had to try to find out something, try to find a manual. So what do you do? Well, even back then we had Google and the web, and a search of available manuals really turned up nothing. So the manual was actually derived from two internal engineering practices that were in place at the lab in two departments. And the team used the documents to build a common sense manual. I'm happy to say that I was one of the co-leads, and the other co-lead is actually on with me today, and that's Jay Thylacker. So Jay and I led this team for the original development. And it had enough interesting events that I'd be glad to share over a cold adult beverage at some point in the future. So, of course, everyone knows finding all knowledge is to use exactly the right keywords when you Google. Try as I may, I just did not succeed. So one thing that I always like to point out to the engineers is that the engineering manual is actually at the very bottom of our requirements. It deals with the sub-assemblies or the assemblies, sometimes the systems. But just like this upside-down pyramid is built, the project requirements sit on top of all of that. Furthermore, there could be requirements that are necessary because of what's called the necessary and sufficient standards or requirements that are part of our contract and consensus standards. So anyone who looks at the engineering manual and says, gee, it's awful thin, it doesn't cover very much, is looking at it as if it's from the project view. The project has very specific project requirements. The necessary and sufficient has requirements. FESHM, Fermi ES&H manual, has requirements. So all of those build up on the engineering manual. So I want to get that out first so that people don't make a mistake and think the manual is going to be very prescriptive and tell them everything there is to know about engineering. So there is a engineering flow chart that was put together. I apologize because I know there is no way that you can read this, but it is based off of the engineering resource guide and it's available at the EPG site. So it's ad.finnell.gov/EPG. And on there, you'll find a link to this engineering flowchart and the policies and various other documents are linked. So the flowchart is actually put together following the chapters in the manual. So it starts with the initiate request, specification production, specification review, risk analysis, system design, design review, procurement and implementation, testing, validation, release to operations, and final documentation. I can say that one place I know that the laboratory has traditionally been weak is in the final documentation. And I'll have a couple words about that later on. So if we look at the chapters again, the summary of the engineering process is the introduction. Chapter one covers requirements and specifications, and I'll say more about some of these in the next slide. Engineering risk analysis. In other words, you actually look at your design and try to determine if what is being asked for is doable or not. And then there is a review, and the review is not on your design, but the review is on the specification and the risk analysis to make sure that things are covered sufficiently. Then we go into system design, which is what everyone would think, and then have an engineering design review. Again, this is a place where Fermilab has had a mixed level of success. Sometimes we have very good engineering design reviews, sometimes we don't. Procurement and implementation. This is a case where we start to work with our colleagues in procurement and make sure that what we're asked to buy is even available and that we can build what we designed. Then we test it, validate it, release it for operations, release them to operations. It just means that it's ready to go. And then comes the final documentation. And final documentation should include a number of different items, including information on how to use the device that you've just designed, and any reviews that were done along the way. There is an appendix to the manual. The manual itself is very short, but the appendix is very large. There's over 200 and some pages. But they are hyper, hyper old. And I've asked a number of times for samples for each chapter. And I'll ask again, please give me new examples, because I don't think you want to know how to specify something from 1975. The idea with the appendix is to show people how to implement the individual chapters, what represents a good document, a good risk analysis, and so on. So these are what I consider to be critical sections. Chapter one, requirements and specifications. Well, why do I say that? If you look down below at the bulleted item, what we hear is, I told you what I wanted and you didn't give it to me. Now you've wasted all my project money. Your boss will hear about it. So it's critical to understand what you're being asked to design. It's critical to go back and have a review to make sure that that person says, yes, that's exactly what I wanted. That's perfect. Okay, you know, we're good to go. Secondly, the risk analysis. So if you look at the bullet down there, I know I can get unobtainium sheets somewhere. Well, the problem is unobtainium may be unattainable. And so here you have a project that you've launched into and you've sort of promised the requester that you can build, and then you find out that you can't. And then chapter three, requirements, engineering, and risk reviews. So I know all there is to know on this subject. I'm sure I didn't miss anything. Or how can it not work? It's only cutting edge, leading edge design. These are things that have all come up throughout my career, listening to various people. It's the type of thing that as a engineer, you want to make sure you don't fall into. And it makes for a happy customer. A happy customer makes your boss happy. And when your boss is happy, good things happen. So that's why I stress these. So the risk analysis. So Jay Thylacker is the expert supreme on the risk analysis. He did the Excel spreadsheet work, did the calculations. So this is intended to be filled out for a project. And to give you an idea, you see there's a 1, 3, and a 5 under technology. It's a gauge. It's something that you and whoever is working with you or whoever your supervisor is on the project fill out to determine just how tough the technology will be. So if it uses off-the-shelf technology, it's going to be rated a one. If it's engineers will purchase and then modify off-the-shelf, well, that could be a little bit trickier. So maybe it's a three. And if the project will require the development of new technology, as I said before, bleeding edge technology, well, then that's going to be a high risk. And the same goes for the environmental impact. You can see if there is no environmental impact, or the project may have some, but not require an environmental assessment as determined by FESHM, or the project will require an environmental impact and perhaps an extensive one approved by DOE, for example. So those get entered on the page, and what is developed from it is a risk summary. So the letters across the top represent the different engineering risk elements, technology, environment, vendor issues, and so on.
You know, I like to have my tools in my shop just like my kitchen gadgets, multi-purpose. And the combo sander is one of those. It combines the functions of a disc sander and a belt sander. Now, generally, this is going to be positioned at the end of your...
I don't know who we have chatting on here, but he's talking about his belt sander. Okay. So you get a scoring. And if you look on the far right side, what you see is standard risk, high risk, standard risk, so on. As you go into the manual, if you go to requirements and specifications, so chapter one, and you have a standard risk, it tells you in there what's expected to be done. If it's a high risk, you have to do more. And you can see that it tracks through both the scoring risk elements and the chapters. So at the end, this is what I would call the engineering risk. There's a similar risk for the project elements, and that is IJK and so on here. And again, you'll come up with a determination of whether it's high risk or not. Now, I know somebody who's a sharp-eyed engineer will say, well, it says a high risk is greater than or equal to 25, yet I've only got a 20 and it says high risk. That's because certain elements in the project risk can generate a high risk assessment. And it just means, again, you need to pay more attention to what's going on in the areas. So here's the project risk elements. We said that we had a high risk in M. Well, holy smokes, project funding. Yeah, I guess that could be a high risk problem if the funding is cut or we don't get the funding profile that we thought we were going to get. Schedule. You know, if they decided they needed it last week and we're just starting on it, then again, this is a high risk problem. So that's the idea behind the risk project elements, and it's both the engineering and project. Design. So don't forget the necessary and sufficient requirements. Many people, many engineers may not have even heard this term. Could somebody please mute whoever has their speaker or their mic on? Thank you. Whoever's on the telephone, please mute. You may not have heard of the necessary and sufficient requirements. So this is a list of standards and rules that we are required by our DOE contract to follow. These are things like the ASME standards, National Electrical Code, et cetera, they are listed in the Fermilab Prime contract that's available on Legal's website. And of course, there are FESHM requirements. Now, the Fermilab necessary and sufficient requirements.
Oh, Paul, if you want to make me a co-host, I'll gladly mute people.
Yeah, well, I would, but I can't see if I can get to it here.
Sorry, I know it's embedded.
Yeah. There you go. Thank you.
Sure.
So, the standards that are in the necessary and sufficient standards have not been kept up to date by DOE. We go back and talk to them and we get assurances that they will be updated. But if you look at many of them, the standard that they cite may be a previous version of ASME or of National Electrical Code. The point is not the specific standard that they're citing, but the fact that you follow the most recent version of those. And as I said, there are FESHM requirements. These are evolving. As the laboratory learns various things, as the mechanical safety, electrical safety subcommittees, cryo subcommittee, as they learn different things, things that have to be done in a design, they show up in FESHM. So engineering design reviews, this is, in my opinion, the last line of defense we have. The review team must be made up of knowledgeable engineers and scientists who can find the things we should not do in a design. And one that I still remember has to do with the use of grease in radioactive components. A target assembly was put together. They used grease on the slides. And after exposure to radiation for not too long a period of time, they could no longer move it because the grease turned into silly putty. And another is not taking into account environmental conditions your design will work in for its lifetime. As we're designing all too often, we think of things being perfect and temperature controlled and no humidity and all the rest of the things that go along with it. At the laboratory, you soon find that that is not the case. And I want to stress this, this is something that, you should hear from your supervisor. You should hear it all the way up and down the line. A design review is not finding fault with you. It's trying to help you find things that you may not have encountered yet, no matter where you are in your career. Don't let a weak review condemn your project to failure. So, what is the engineering manual? Hopefully it's a common sense method to approach design of a needed item. Hopefully it can keep you on track and out of trouble. The approach works no matter how expensive or critical the item. If you're building a coffee warmer for me, it's obviously a very highly critical item. So you're going to follow it. It's going to be high risk because I'd be really upset if my coffee gets cold. The manual was developed by Fermilab engineers for Fermilab engineers and any other technical person doing design. This point is often missed. Everybody who does technical work is supposed to follow the principles of the engineering manual. At the time it was written, there were none. I mentioned that before. There are at least three other labs that have copied our manual, modified it for their own use. I'm happy to say LBNL or LBL now has their own manual in place of the Black Book. So it's not overly prescriptive. It provides what should be done in a graded approach fashion. It even tells you what graded approach is. So there is a new section on transportation and a risk analysis. It's not finalized yet, but it will be. There's also a new section where I show reliability and availability calculations. There are two real-world, fully developed calculations that are shown there. It's a good thing to look through. It's a couple different ways of doing it. And those are also available off that engineering resource guide. And I stress again that the EPG in that is capitalized or you won't find it. If you've got suggestions, or if you want to add things, send me an email. My email's on the bottom, and we can work on it. So, questions or comments? Number one, the reason why I want to be an engineer. there's a little sliver of actually doing engineering, but I want to be able to say, trust me, I'm an engineer. So with that, let me stop share. There we go. Jay.
Yeah, Paul, you said something very early on that that got me thinking. And that is, you mentioned that new engineers may not even know that the engineering manual exists. And it seems like it'd be a very easy solution to automatically have anyone with an engineering category that's new have an ITNA requirement that they read the engineering manual and then do the the simplified test.
Yeah.
just to make sure they know it exists.
That's a good idea. I mean, it shows up on Fermilab policies and a few other places, the EPG thing, but you're right, we should add it to the ITNAs. I think it's a great idea. Thanks, Jay.
Okay.
Adam?
Thanks, Paul. I think that the risk analysis spreadsheet is one of the most, it's kind of, to me, the biggest focal point of using the engineering manual. It's a great way to summarize how a project went through the process. So what happens to a particular project's version of that spreadsheet in the lifecycle of a project? Does that document get saved in TeamCenter or something like that?
Well, therein lies the problem. Are we using TeamCenter? Are we using EDMS? Are we using DocDB? This is something that we have to face yet. There was going to be a move to use EDMS, but CERN told us not to because they're going to do a major rewrite. So at some point, it'll have to get folded into a common. Right now, it's usually saved with, or should be saved with, the project information.
Okay, so. Thank you.
Lydia.
Hi, Paul. Although it's important that engineers understand and implement the engineering manual to obtain whatever final engineering deliverable is expected of them, I think parts of the manual are probably most applicable to department and division heads who are responsible for actually bringing on projects on site and ensuring their successful and safe execution by determining which documents you actually need, what sort of resources you need, what sort of additional safety measures or requirements you're going to need. And a lot of times those are not engineers doing this. So I think that's a very vital element to missing a lot of the aspects that are required of the engineering manual and not seeing them be executed, just because I think it's actually a whole lab or project kind of education that's required amongst the staff. So what are your thoughts on this, and how do we approach this to kind of get department heads and division heads to even start thinking this way?
So engineering is it's the M9 in CAS. I don't know if you made that talk, but Contractor Assurance Systems now has engineering. It has M9. It's been there for about 3 years. And as a result, every year, I have to go out and do a survey on a different aspect of engineering with the different divisions. So I send out a letter to the division or section head saying, we, the Royal, are going to be doing an assessment of engineering in your section. The first one I did 2 years ago dealt with the use of the engineering manual. And it was, in fact, an eye-opener for the some of the division heads or section heads. So it is becoming more of a standard, let's say, and I hope it continues to spread that way. But that's a good question and a good point, Lydia. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of piggybacks off of Jay's comment as well, right? A new engineer should be expected to execute the elements of the manual, but at the same time, project leaders should as well. No matter what size of the project there is.
That's right. Just
something I think should continue to think about on how to actually execute these projects efficiently.
Okay, well, everyone. It's 1:31. We've gone 1 minute over. Cindy, can you make it quick?
Sure. Thanks, Paul. I wanted to ask about communication and whether that is the importance of that or guides on how to communicate well was any part of the design or the engineering manual.
Well, communications is obviously important, and that's why I use the LHC quadrupole as an example. The point there was that you can't rely on verbal communications only, because that can let you down. So had they actually written down the requirement and what they wanted done, they wouldn't have had that problem. We have a innovators celebration that starts now. It's on a different link. Thank you, everybody. If you have additional questions or comments, please send them to me. I'm always interested. And if you have examples that you would like to send me so I can put them in the appendix and update that. Thanks, everybody. Have a great day.